120 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Kind of a drizzly day out there. We usually have such bright and shiny weather for the air show, which I'm sure many of you have heard overhead, but we will keep you updated at the top and bottom of every hour as weather rolls in and out of the area the rest of the weekend for sure. Well, lots to do on the show today. A little bit later in the after 12:30, we're going to be talking a little bit about housing, specifically around how luxury apartments are starting to pop up more and more around college campuses and how that affects lower income students, I'm sure, quite a bit. But right now, we're joined by Stephen Strahler, who's a reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, who wrote about the ongoing disputes about how much the state can tax its proposed new casinos. For those of you who listen to Crain's Daily Gist, I talked about this a little bit earlier in the week with Greg Hines when this news first broke about the Illinois Gaming Commission. They commissioned a report, and the report, you know, it didn't really mince words. So let's take a deeper look at that. Stephen, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
So talk us through this. On the 13th, there was this this consultant report that came out that said, you know, this is almost unfundable. This idea of this casino is not quite as viable, perhaps, as we originally thought. What is the latest? And maybe catch us up for people who haven't been following the story too closely.
Well, we thought it would be a good idea just to look at, well, what's the practice in other states? What level might be feasible? And so I looked at the other states, not 50, of course, that have gambling, casinos, and other betting, and I found that on average, the taxation rate is about 23%. There are other states that have a higher tax rate than Illinois, Maryland, among them, but they have different levels for slot machine betting, taxation, and table games. And the table game tax is much lower in those other states than it is in Illinois. Illinois' tax graduates to 50% of what are called adjusted gross receipts or the revenue that a casino takes in after paying out the winnings.
So the report indicated that it was, you know, we're looking at about 72% tax on the revenue of that casino, which I think it seemed like it kind of chilled that conversation. There was a lot of excitement. I think a lot of speculation among lawmakers around this idea of this casino. And it suddenly seemed like the vibe changed very much earlier this week when that report came out. And so, you know, have you, I'm sure it might be a little too early to tell, but what are the adjustments that you're seeing so far in that conversation from lawmakers?
Well, obviously the 72% figure is before other charges, including interest and taxes. So the report pointed out that the maximum margin before interest and other charges would be about 3% on any one of these five sites, which of course, proposed sites, which of course did not include a downtown location, which could be expected to be more lucrative. But the big, what causes that number to be so high is the so-called privilege tax that's included in the bill, allowing Chicago to tax at a 33.3% rate. And that was inserted as a substitute for earlier proposals that the city would own a large chunk of a casino, a third or a half of it. So what some people, at least the gaming association in Illinois, I talked to the executive director there, one solution he proposed was to have the graduated income tax on casino receipts, which I said rises to 50%, ultimately at some threshold that would have impact the Chicago casino only because of its potential size, that rate would reverse and go down to a lower, say, to a 40% level. Mm. And he suggested that if something like that were adopted, you know, it could very well, you know, be profitable enough to attract bidders to operate it.
Yeah. So as you were looking at other states, in particular, you mentioned Maryland with that 61% and Pennsylvania at 54%. What stood out to you just kind of looking across all the states you studied and their, you know, casino operations strategy and their revenue from those operations? What really stood out to you as significant or very different from other states?
Well, it's just a patchwork, state by state regulation. There are all kinds of exceptions. To do a comprehensive study of, just how much revenue each state derives and how it goes about it would be a complex undertaking. There are all kinds, there's different taxes on different types of games. There's some carve-outs. There's one of the models that someone pointed me to was for an urban casino has just been approved outside of Boston by Wynn Resorts. So we'll probably be taking a look at that and see if it offers any lessons for Chicago.
It's really very interesting. I think with this new detail, this report that's emerged, it'll be very interesting to see kind of who steps up and who backs away and how it ends up shaking out. Earlier in the week when I talked to Greg Hines about this on the Daily Gist, he mentioned how even in Detroit, there's sort of an interesting model because that's government owned. And I think that was sort of he got the sense anyway, is what he said, was that it seemed like no one really wanted that to be the case here. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes. This is Illinois, after all.
You're right.
And given, any corruption sentiment aside, we have this downstate Chicago split in this state that many states don't. So to get a majority of the state legislature to approve a Chicago-owned casino, I don't think it would fly.
No, probably not. And probably it's probably for the best that it would not.
Right. But the opportunity here is, despite the prospect of a super saturated market, remember this gaming bill is going to triple the number of authorized positions in the state. Mm-hmm. And we already have this major gambling casino operations just across the border in Illinois. Nevertheless, a tourist-oriented casino in downtown Chicago could offer an operator enough revenue that despite the high taxes, they'll want to come in here.
And would that likely be one of the really large gaming companies, or would that be someone who already has a route here through maybe Arlington Park or one of the companies associated with Aurora and Joliet gaming facilities?
Yes, it's no doubt it's going to be a sophisticated operator. A number of the current operators of gambling positions in Illinois have said that they're not interested. Mm. Or haven't commented. We'll see how what revisions in the law will do to their thinking on that. But one of the operators that I've cited is Churchill Downs, which operates, of course, the namesake racetrack in Louisville, mm-hmm. It already owns a majority stake in the largest revenue-producing casino in the state, and that's in Des Plaines, Rivers Casino. And it also owns Arlington Park, which the new gaming law is allowing to, put slot machines and other gambling opportunities in. So, and they have said that they're interested in bidding on one of the six new licenses authorized. So I would keep an eye on them.
Yeah, well, we certainly shall, and we will keep turning to you for the latest. Thanks so much for being with us, Stephen Strahler, reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, have a good one. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to keep this casino topic rolling. We're going to take a look at how the casino business has played out in another community that it meant to revitalize, didn't quite make it there. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. Always appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday morning with me, or afternoon. It's technically after. It feels like morning. It's kind of a sleep late and stay in bed kind of rainy day out there for sure. Hope you're staying nice and dry. Lots to do still here on the show. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the proposed casino site here in Illinois and what that would look like revenue-wise, what that would look like tax rate-wise. We're joined now by Jesse McKinley, who is the Albany Bureau Chief at the New York Times. I want to keep this topic of casinos going because Jesse wrote just this week about a New York casino that was meant to revitalize a community but has really only reported losses since it opened. And so thanks so much for being with us today, Jesse. Welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Happy to.
Oh, so talk us through the story that you recently wrote about this casino in New York for those listening who may not be familiar.
Well, this is a $1.2 billion operation that was opened in the Catskills, which was traditionally kind of a vacation getaway for generations of New Yorkers, kind of north of New York City, but had fallen on hard times. So one of the ideas of Governor Andrew Cuomo, New York's governor, was to kind of allow a new casino to open in the Catskills. And to that end, they licensed a $1.2 billion operation in a small town known as Monticello. And they kind of had high hopes that this would really turn that community around, that it would pour a bunch of money into local businesses. And thus far, they've done nothing but lose money every quarter since they opened 2 years ago. So it's been a real disappointment in terms of the owners of this, which is a Malaysian firm by the name of Genting, one of the largest casino operators in the world, operating through a subsidiary, but they just have not found the profits that they anticipated there.
And so why is that? I mean, when we're talking about showing a loss, it's pretty big numbers, as you note in the story. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out after the program so you can read it for yourself. But according to a recent filing with the SEC, as you note in the story, this company showed a $36 million loss in the second quarter of 2019. I mean, that's a pretty significant number. What happened based, you know, what happened from the plan to make money here to what the reality is in the actuals?
Well, I think what you're seeing in the Northeast and in a lot of parts of the country is, you know, there was a day and age in which casino gambling was extremely limited, where you could only go to Las Vegas or certain spots in Atlantic City or places like that to throw some dice or play some cards. But that was then. And nowadays, there's casinos in dozens of states. There are, you know, other forms of gambling, whether it be lottery gambling, sports wagering, which has recently been legalized in a number of states. So there's a real saturation in the casino market. You know, there are simply too many casinos for many analysts' tastes, and too few players. And when, you know, it's like with any other business, when you get competition, the stress on trying to find a profit out of the, you know, kind of, you know, cannibalization of the marketplace becomes more and more intense. And that's what you're seeing in New York State and certainly in other parts. You know, New York is bordered by New Jersey, which has casino gambling. It's bordered by Massachusetts, which has casino gambling. It's bordered by Connecticut, which has casino gambling. It's bordered by Pennsylvania, which has casino gambling. So these are all other states that are in the have skin in the game, so to speak, and are, you know, stealing their New York players or holding players that might be inclined to go to New York closer to home, you know, in places like Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, or certainly New Jersey or Connecticut, or, you know, just recently Boston opened a casino, a $1 billion casino in downtown Boston. So that's just another example of the competition just increasing more and more.
Well, and I've wondered that very thing, that as gambling has become legal in other states, as we're moving towards this, will that saturation really just kind of hurt all of them? Will gambling no longer be kind of the special and quasi taboo thing that you go to and you do in Vegas and Atlantic City, and that's about it? I mean, I've wondered that same thing. I mean, as you've been looking at this and reporting out this story, did you get that sense that this big idea might actually end up being to the detriment of existing gambling places?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, what's interesting about when you cover casino gambling is that the casino itself, the house always wins. You know, this is the old maxim, and it holds true. they tend to make money just in terms of operations month to month. You know, they win more than they lose, but the cost of actually running a casino can be quite high. There's a lot of, particularly with table games, there's a lot of employees you have to pay. And oftentimes they go into enormous amounts of debt in order to build these kind of very glitzy casinos. You know, in the case of the one that I looked at in Monticello, New York, you know, they're writing $500 million worth of loans running at 10%. And those are some pretty steep margins to make. And then also when you talk to analysts and people that, you know, kind of watch this from a financial viewpoint, there really is kind of a fatigue, I think, around casino gambling in a lot of places. You know, that once again, the novelty of this has really worn off. Like it used to be a kind of special thing to go to a casino, but now there's casinos everywhere. So it's less and less kind of a you know, a big special trip and something that people might do weekly or even daily, depending on your appetite for that sort of entertainment.
Yeah, it's something I think on a lot of minds here in Chicago as we're talking about the proposed downtown casino site, what that might look like to have a casino here nearby when we have one, when we have some right across the border in Indiana, when we have them out about an hour or so outside of the city in Aurora. You know, it's a kind of an interesting topic that I think a lot of people are wrestling with here. So I really appreciate you joining us for perspective on how this played out in New York. Thank you so much, Jesse McKinley, Albany Bureau Chief at the New York Times. Thanks for your time today. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all the good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hello there. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do on the program. We're joined now by Ali Breland, who is a tech writer at Mother Jones, who wrote about the proliferation of luxury apartments near college campuses and how they are impacting low-income students. Ali, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
But yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So talk us through this story. It's a really interesting one. And let me say that for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program so you can read it for yourself, because there's a lot of really interesting detail in this story. But talk us through, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's an important story. I'm glad I got to do it with Type Investigations and Bloomberg. But basically what it was that I sort of looked at the off-campus housing situation around different college campuses and looked at the link between the rise of sort of luxury developers and the units that they were putting in correlation with the rents in a lot of these areas, and did notice that in certain sort of competitive markets, there appeared to be a correlation, and there's reason to think there might be causation, but it's hard to parse these things out for sure, but there's reason to think there might be a causation between these sorts of very expensive buildings that were going up and increases in rent that were pushing poorer students further and further from campus, and making it harder for them to have the same opportunities to live near campus as their wealthier peers.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting story with a lot of really, really important numbers and important details in there that I think are really important. Why did you initially, what brought you to this story initially?
Yeah, so I'm about 27 years old right now, and I think there's a lot of people who are about my age who went to college at the same time as me who noticed this. I saw this happen firsthand directly. I kind of saw the direct initial wave of this. I talked to researchers and experts, and they said there's not really a lot of good research or writing in this space because it's such a new phenomenon. And so just naturally watching how my peers sort themselves out when I was in school, and some of us have to live further away and just commute further to campus, was a thing that put me onto this originally. And then this is a conversation that I've had with friends for years, just kind of seeing what the situation was on different campuses. And I noticed that this was a recurring motif across the country. And even since I published the story, people have told me about their own similar experiences in other cities. They said that this is happening in Buffalo or versions of it and other places across the country.
Interesting. And so in the story, you mentioned an organization called American Campus Communities. Talk to us about what that is and what they do.
American Campus Communities is a sort of pioneer of changing the sort of student housing game. Back in the 70s and 80s, people initially looked at the student housing market as a very unprofitable sort of sketchy area where they thought students were pretty irresponsible and not great tenants. But what American campus communities realized was that there was always going to be a solid flow of tenants near college campuses. And what they realized, too, is that they were all going to need and want to be near campus. And so American campus community prioritizes being as close to campus as possible at almost all of their properties. This is something that they talk about in their 10K annual statement to their shareholders. And so they really revolutionized the game. They started creating slightly higher-end housing and increasingly making more luxury spaces. And then that spun off a bunch of competitors who realized how profitable this was. And a lot of other companies started making even more luxurious, really nice housing to cater to this class of kids that were coming in whose parents are paying for their education, whose parents are paying for their housing, and who could afford a lot more because it wasn't just their own, you know, meager college student incomes. It was the incomes of their parents who had been successful in the previous generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you note in the story what a big piece housing is of student debt as it kind of stands right now, which is, you know, which is really significant. I think, you know, every student, you know, we've all been in that point where you're like, well, you know, you get what the, you get the apartment you can afford. And indeed, those sometimes are not in, you know, the best area sometimes, because you can kind of, you do what you can when you're a student, knowing on the other side of graduation, eventually, theoretically, I'll have a job and I'll be doing better and I'll live somewhere nicer then. But the piece of student debt connected to housing is really pretty significant. I think when we talk about student debt, we tend to focus that conversation primarily just on tuition costs and rising tuition costs. And we don't tend to talk about how big a piece just housing is.
Yeah, I think you're totally right that housing is in many cases often half of what it costs for some students. Sometimes it's even more, as I kind of looked into in the story. And it's really unfortunate, too, because in certain states, you know, like some of the colleges that I looked at, University of Washington, University of Texas, University of Michigan, you know, if those are some of the best public colleges in each state. And so if you don't have the money to go to a private school and you're trying to go to the best public college you can, just because of the cost of housing and how much that factors in the debt calculus that you have to make, if you don't have a lot of money, that really makes these schools inaccessible for you, which kind of runs counter to the mission of these sorts of public institutions. And or you can take on the debt, which happened to one student, Dominic, I spoke with, and that caused a whole host of problems for her. It was really stressful for her, and that's probably something she's going to have to deal with for the rest of her life. But just the amount of money and debt that she's taking on just from housing alone.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I mean, you open with a story, or you open with a kind of a profile of a student at University of Texas, and then a bit later in the story, you note that, let me find it, it says, at UT Austin, the median annual rent in the neighborhoods closest to campus exceeds the annual in-state tuition, about $11,000 for the upcoming academic year, even without including the costs, utilities, groceries, things like that. That's very significant. I mean, we're talking about debt that you carry for decades, if not, you know, most of the rest of your life. That's, you know, that's kind of a heartbreaking number. That's a gutting number that I don't think is encouraging to very many families.
No, not at all. And it really does start to contribute to things like income and wealth inequality. I mean, even if you do come out, I think in Dominique's case, if I'm remembering correctly, I think she was trying to pursue a career as a physician's assistant, which does pay well, but she's going to be at a significant disadvantage as to her peers who are just coming away with way less debt, whose parents are able to front they were lucky enough to have their parents be able to pay for their where they lived. And so, yeah, it is very heartbreaking. It's sad to hear.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a fascinating topic, and I feel like just the piece of college and affording it has been so up in the news just in the last, you know, couple of months with the college admissions scandal of here's, you know, very wealthy families getting their kids into schools and through some scrupulous means, allegedly. And then, you know, here in Illinois, we've been looking at this guardianship issue that's allowed students to qualify for financial aid they otherwise wouldn't qualify for. And it's really, I mean, it really to me points at a lot of haves and have nots and this just how, even when we're looking at a public university that we like to think everyone has access to, it's just really, really just not the case. So I think these are important things to talk about. So I really appreciate you being with us today. Ali Breland, tech writer at Mother Jones, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Certainly. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, plenty more to talk about here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We're tracking that weather for you that's moving through the area. I know those of you who are really gung-ho about the air and water show, which I'm sure most of you are. We're going to be keeping an eye on that. It has been delayed a little bit, but it is scheduled to resume. So it's usually lots of people out on North Avenue Beach. I'm sure if anyone's out there right now, you're getting soaked. But dog ears are getting a break, because I know there's a lot of dogs in my neighborhood. Yesterday, as they were, I was walking out to the train, and I could see a bunch of dogs as the planes were flying over. They were all like, "What's happening? What is this? The world is coming to an end."
I know. I feel, but all summer long, they I feel for them.
I know, poor little things. Imagine if you're a dog and you hear like a blue angel flying over, you're like, "What in the world? I have to protect my humans from something right now."
John talked to Steve Dale about that.
Yeah, what did he say?
John was mentioning it on the show previous to this one. I think he had a bunch of advice. One was TV, radio, which you think actually
would overwhelm them.
When I put it on for my dog, I think I'm doing this for my benefit. The dog doesn't care. Like, I think they would like to have it on, but he said that it's comforting in some ways. An item that has your scent on it, leave it behind.
That's nice.
If you can.
Yeah.
If you create some kind of enclosed space that they can go into or something.
Poor little thing.
I know.
My mom's, one of my mom's dogs, she gets so freaked out by noise. They don't live in this area, but around like 4th of July and stuff like that, this poor dog just hides under tables and cries and all that. But they like that, what's it called, the thunder shirt? Like, it's a jacket that...
The thunder shirt, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of like, it's kind of the idea of like swaddling a dog. That kind of calms her down. A little bit, but also TV works for them. Like, they have this, they'll put it on like, the Discovery Channel or something. This dog will respond to stuff on the screen.
Right. Yeah. He was taking texts about that earlier today, because people then, were saying the same stuff that, like, if there's a commercial with dogs in it, especially.
Yeah. Or in particular, if there's fish on the screen, like when they show like Shark Week and things like that, this dog will like, oh my gosh, and she'll like go up to the screen and try to paw at them. It's really
funny.
Oh,
that's so strange. That's hilarious.
They had to move the TV up because the dog kept like trying to bite the fish. It was really funny and cute. Anyway, totally unrelated to that. We talk a lot about where technology is catching up in interesting ways, where it's filling in gaps, where it's sometimes fixing problems we did not realize we had. But we've also been talking a lot about what kind of, I don't want to say battles because that's a bit dramatic, but there's been some tensions between restaurants and delivery companies. Just recently, there was a story that I tweeted about a little bit about how some restaurants have been kind of miffed at Yelp for changing phone numbers on their listings so it would route through Grubhub and things like that, and kind of give people an extra marketing bump, things like that. But there's a story in the New York Times, which I will definitely tweet out after the program, and it's about the rise of the virtual restaurant. That's pretty interesting. So it's the idea that they're is not a restaurant there. It's not an actual restaurant. It's just a website with delivery capabilities. I mean, you obviously have to make the food, but it's not a place you go and you dine. It's entirely constructed for delivery. What is your opinion about that, Griffin?
Well, I wasn't aware of these. I don't get delivery that much anyway.
There's one on Michigan Avenue not far from here.
Oh, really?
I've walked by that and been like, oh, that sounds kind of appetizing. How do I go in? And I was like looking at the door and I'm like, oh, and it was just like Grubhub and DoorDash stuff all over the...
It's like one of those we sell your stuff on eBay stores from back in the day.
Can I just go in and look at the purses? No, just go to eBay. Okay, it's exactly like that.
Why do you have a storefront? I'm interested. This story enlightened me to like all the good and some of the bad, too. So I was reading through it, kind of going back and forth. But I am definitely interested in the idea that if I'm scrolling through one of these apps, there is... someone who's doing that, they're there to exclusively do delivery. A lot of the time you're ordering from places and you're like, oh, is that going to travel well, this mm-hmm. item? And sometimes they have a specific, actually usually they have a specific menu that's just for delivery. Certain things you can't get delivered.
And as we've talked about on the show, I think this was probably 3 or 4 months ago, we talked about how some packaging is being re-engineered to kind of accommodate delivery stuff, so it's not like a big pile of mush by the time you get it.
Right. But you do wonder, like, oh, is that going to travel well? Should I bother ordering that? And, with places like this, presumably that the answer would be yes, that this is what they do. There's no transfer in quality.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like what you're getting at home, that's what they expect you to have. So, And then, so I think I'm pro, but I'm curious about what it means to the landscape of
I am too.
Restaurants like this.
That's where my head goes. I'm always like, okay, what is this? How is this going to affect like a small business? I don't know. I think it's interesting. It certainly is, you know, it would potentially save, you know, if you want to get into the restaurant business, you're like, you know, here's my idea. I do want to offer delivery. I do at this point would need to, okay, hire delivery drivers, set up the delivery side of the business and also set up a dining room and all, you know, you would certainly rent a different type of space than you would if you also needed the dining room as opposed to like, I just need the commercial kitchen and a door where drivers can come up, grab the order and zip on out and get the food out. I don't know. I think it's kind of an interesting idea, but it's kind of another one of those spaces where just kind of technology kind of snuck up on us and like, oh, why didn't I think of that?
That's right. Well, that's what I was thinking too. When I read this story, I was like, I think I knew that this existed, but I just didn't think about it much. And it states that in the U.S., these kinds of things date back to like 2013 at least. But the app infrastructure for restaurant delivery didn't exist at the time. It wasn't as prevalent. So actually, I think the first ones that tried it ended up closing up shop a few years later.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I don't know. I'll say this because I think I've said this on the air before. I feel very guilty ordering food. I rarely do. I mean, I cook a lot anyway. So I got to be like real tired or if I'm sick or something and I just don't want to cook or something. But I don't know. I don't order a lot of food because I feel guilty doing it. I'm like, someone's got to bring me my food. I'm okay. I can just go get it. That's fine.
Right.
So I usually will go pick it up. But on the rare occasions I have ordered, I really end up, I think we're in a moment where there's so much going on in the food delivery space that we need to figure out. The person that comes in and streamlines it and makes it better is going to win.
Right.
Because I don't think any solution is perfect. For example, there is a wonderful taqueria near my home that I've, you know, walked by many times, stopped in there, gotten food, taken it home. I've dined in there. It's a lovely place. It's totally delicious. And one night I wasn't feeling well and I was like, I'm going to order food from that. That sounds really good because they have this wonderful soup. And I was like, soup and tacos, it's going to be good. I order it and I went to their website, and when I hit like the button that said order online, it sent me off to a third party site where I completed the order and processed my, you know, card number, my debit card number and all that stuff. Okay. Quite a bit of time goes by and I'm like, well, I mean, this seems like it's been like 90 minutes and they're literally four blocks away. So this seems a little weird. I called them. They didn't. I ended up kind of routing through this phone tree because it was like, well, we'll do this and this is here. We don't know this driver's here. We don't have any. We gave the driver the order at this time, but we don't have any control over that. I was like, can you call him? They're like, well, no, we don't. He's not our person.
Right.
He doesn't work here. So I just felt like it short circuits customer service issues. And they felt really terrible. And they were like, well, hey, get a pen. Write down this code. Next time you're in, use this coupon. We're so sorry. I was like, well, it's not your fault. I mean, if you got the order to the guy 10 minutes later and, you know, he's been driving around doing some other stuff. You know, I can't. It's not your fault. I'm not going to take a hit on your revenue. So I didn't use the coupon.
But it's also like I'm not going to input more information and make this a more complicated process next time because I don't trust it already.
Right. So it's kind of like what if it's like I don't remember who the I think it was maybe Caviar where you had to order food for them. So it was like if the Caviar driver like they can't the Caviar driver is not an employee of that taqueria, so they have no control over they can't punish him or her for taking 2 hours to get somewhere. You know?
No. Yeah. It's a crowded kind of oddly shaped space in a lot of ways. Like and that's what's attractive about these things, I think. Right. It's like I'm going straight through the restaurant. This is what they're for. They know how to get the food to me. Now, restaurants who do delivery on Uber Eats, which is one of the main players in this space, already, you know, they're already paying a commission and they have to staff waiters and pay for a space that these delivery only restaurants don't have to. So they, I think, are right now and will increasingly feel like it's not a level playing field. Like we already have to do all this other stuff and pay the commission.
Right.
They're taking a shortcut and they're being, you know, a lot Uber Eats has helped start a lot of these restaurants too because it's in their interest. I think the number in the story was around 4,000 are at least being incubated by Uber Eats because they want to populate their, you know, app with a bunch of new options. So it's possible that traditional restaurant owners might feel a little put off by that, but you know, we'll see how it progresses.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting one. I'm gonna tweet this out after the program because they in the story they talk to a lot of the two writers that worked on this. One of them is Mike Isaac, who we've had on the program before. But I think they talk to a lot of restaurant owners who said, you know, delivery used to be, you know, about a quarter of my business. Now it's about 75%. So it just made sense for me to do this. So I think it's really interesting. And I think we should be really thoughtful about how we interact with this and make sure we're doing it in a way that isn't hurting businesses, but also isn't, you know, putting drivers in a bad position. I don't know. It's complicated. So we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I will find out what Scott Catoon has coming up on the Startup Showcase back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.